accession number 12502. This is reel 14.
Field Marshal Bramall, reel 14.
You were saying, I think, that it was necessary to have tank gunners capable of taking out two enemy vehicles per minute, say, and switching swiftly from one target to another.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think it was possible, even with our old equipment. But, I mean, of course, one of the faults of the British tank over recent years is that its fire control equipment has not been as good as the latest generation of American and British. And, of course, this is what Challenger 2, we hope, will rectify. Because it is this question of switching from one target to the other, which is so vitally important. And this wasn't easily done on the British tank.
On the other hand, the Israelis did achieve a phenomenal rate of
destruction. You're absolutely right. I mean, with the old Centurion.
1973 on the Golan Heights.
Yes, this is right. And this, of course, is what I tried to get across. I said the crucial thing to winning battles in the North German plain was good gunnery. And this was something that we... No, I don't think we were good enough. The Israelis went on and on and on until they got it absolutely perfect, and this is something we've always got to do. The new equipment will make it easier, but we haven't been as good as we ought to be.
Now, we were also discussing the use of guided weapons as opposed to the use of guns, and it was around about this time, I think, that the idea was prevalent that the gun was on the way out and that the guided weapon would replace it, because it had more flexibility and it was more deadly.
Well, maybe one day they will find a guided weapon that is, but of course, first of all, it's a much less certain... the guided weapons, the generation of guided weapons that I was dealing with was a much less certain weapon. It wasn't a fire-and-forget weapon. You had to steer it onto the target over an agonizing period of time, which, with all the stresses and strains of battle and so on, and the target moving, whereas the gun was a much, much more, if you got it on the sights and you were aiming in the right place, you would hit, there would be no argument about that. And secondly, of course, it had a much, much smaller and different type of warhead, which was not good against some of the better Russian armour. Whereas the gun, with the steadily being improved ammunition and the sheer weight of the projectile, would go through anything that we wanted to. So in that sense, it was the gun was more efficient. And, of course, it was fired from a much more protective launcher. I mean, you could, of course, put guided weapons inside launchers, but by and large, they were much less well protected. And I still actually am a believer in that the best anti-tank weapon is still, or has been, the tank. And, of course, the tank has the added advantage of you being able to move quickly round the flank or even round the back of your enemy and to attack him from more embarrassing directions, and of course where the armour is less on the side and the back, where it is much easier to knock the tank out, and of course you have an offensive capability in the tank which you don't have in the guided weapon. I think you need a mixture of these things, and of course you're looking for a guided weapon which you will be able to fire and forget about, which will find its target and which will do great destruction when it gets the other end, perhaps by attacking the vehicle from the top. But we didn't have that equipment. We had things like swing fire, which was a fairly unreliable weapon, which wasn't all that easy to direct onto the target, and when it got to the target was far less lethal than the tank gun.
It didn't have the kinetic impact.
No, exactly. It had a hollow charge and it could be defeated by any armour which was spaced.
Were you well equipped for close air defence?
No, I don't think we were well equipped as close air defence. I mean, I think this was one of the troubles. We had very, very few anti-aircraft guns. The trouble was that an anti-aircraft gun, an effective anti-aircraft gun or weapon mounted on an armoured chassis, was a very, very expensive piece of equipment indeed. We didn't have very many of them. We relied on air cover, which might have been some time coming, and we had first-generation handheld weapons like blowpipe, who, whenever I saw it, I was reminded of the Duke of Wellington's remark, "I don't know what it does to the enemy, but my God, it frightens me." And it wasn't all that reliable. And in fact, when we went to the Falklands, I think the second generation of blowpipe, which is called something quite different, is a much better weapon. But this first generation was not all that exciting, and when we went to the Falklands, we were very glad to get some Stingers from the Americans, which were rather more effective. So this was again rather important that we didn't declare our position to the enemy too early, because we didn't have all that air support, and so we relied on dispersal and concealment, and only coming into the battle at the last minute, when we would be too close for his air attack to have a great deal of effect.
What sort of liaison arrangements did you have with the Royal Air Force?
Well, we had air staff officers, of course, at certainly at division, who were there to help us with our Harriers, and we had forward air controllers who could direct air support, and we had staff officers who could help us with helicopters if we ever had any helicopters given to us for a particular space of time. I think all that was getting much better, but of course there was still this great dilemma. I won't say it was an argument. I mean, it was a real dilemma for the Air Force. Where was their effort most necessary? Was it in winning the air battle, which meant, of course, going for German and for Russian airfields wherever they were, and eventually getting a state when there were more Allied aircraft around than there were Russian aircraft, or should the whole thing have been thrown into support of the land battle? And you could argue both ways, of course, but the soldier tends to say, it's all very well you winning the air battle, but while you're winning the air battle, we're being defeated on the ground. And so the result was some sort of compromise, and of course the Harriers were more or less directed entirely to supporting the land battle. And the Tornadoes and the Phantoms, and mostly Phantoms in those days, of course, were directed more to targets designed to win the air battle.
Were they talking in terms of follow-on force attack at this stage? In other words, concentrating on the second echelon rather than the first echelon of the Soviet advance?
With the Harriers, do you mean?
No, with the Harriers
were more on the first echelon. Certainly, one would, provided on firm intelligence, one would have hoped to have got some of the air effort onto the second echelon. Certainly, that would be certainly true. But this would be done at core level.
At what level did the forward air controllers operate? How far down the tactical chain of command did they go?
Oh, the forward air controller, well, he was a self-contained thing. I mean, he wouldn't necessarily be with our headquarters. He would be where he could see. He would be where he could see to bring in aircraft. And so it would be, he would be behind the killing areas or wherever it may be.
Do you remember how many of them you had with the division?
I can't remember how many I had.
Now, we were discussing the Germans.
Not enough, I suspect.
But more than at Goodwood, where there was only one per division, as I remember.
Yes, there would have been more than that.
We discussed the German forces. Did you see anything of the Americans?
Not too much, because, of course, the Germans were up in our area. And we used to do various... We got working eventually in my time in command very closely with the Germans. We had a great socialising together, and we did a thing called a tactical picnic, which we took the officers of both divisions out, that's the 1st Panzer Grenadier Division and my division, out onto the ground to discuss our respective war plans and discuss tactical problems, so that was very good. We saw quite a lot of them. And as I say, I think their officers, in particular senior officers, were very impressive. The Americans we didn't. They were in a completely different sector, of course, down in the south, and we saw very little of them. We saw bits occasionally on NATO exercises of some of the Dutch and some of the Danes, who looked pretty wild and woolly. One didn't know quite... I mean, they were obviously... less expert, they were conscripts, they were not regulars, their equipment wasn't really as good, and one felt that in a fight that the really only solid allies would be the Germans and presumably the Americans, but they were further south.
So I think by this stage the Dutch Corps was stationed in the Netherlands itself?
Well, I think it was beginning on the point of going back. I think when I was there, it was in Germany, or parts of it were in Germany. But I think during the course of that time, and certainly a little later, it started all the road back.
I think this was to save the foreign exchange,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I'm sure that's right.
Mm. Did you see anything at all of the Belgians? Because they would also have been...
Well, the Belgians were a critical place because they were just down to the south of my division. And one of the, if there was a penetration in their area, we had to move down into a counter-penetration role. So I think it was difficult to tell whether they'd be there on the day and how well they would do. Sometimes they might have done unexpectedly well, but... We kept a weather eye open in that direction.
Were the Canadians in your area, or were they?
No,
well,
the Canadian area was down in the south.
You mentioned having a good social contact with the Germans. Did you have good social contact with the Air Force?
With our own Royal Air Force?
Yes.
Oh, well, I'm certain that we tried to... Yes, I'm certain that we tried to bring the Air Force in whenever we could on study periods and study days. And I was never conscious of any sort of... I mean, I do know the two commanders-in-chief sat in next-door offices, and depending on their personalities, they either got on very well or not as well as they did do. At some stage, I suspect it was before I arrived, but I'm not certain, it might have been the early days, I understand that the Air Force Commander-in-Chief, the offices were side by side and there was a door in between. And the Air Force Commander-in-Chief said, under no circumstances is that door ever to be opened. But after that, as far as I know, there was a great... they worked extremely well together. And I wasn't conscious. I mean, obviously, there were occasionally different viewpoints, but I wasn't conscious of any sort of vendetta or anything between the two services, and it would have been my duty to have brought the RAF in on study periods and exercises as much as we possibly could. And I do remember, certainly, them doing marvellous attacks on our troops in the course of exercises, where it really gave our people an idea of what it was like to be... strafed by low-flying aircraft. And I'm a tremendous person, I always have been, for joint operations, and it's the only way it'll work.
Did you make any changes to your divisional headquarters while you were in office, or did you just carry on using the machinery and techniques that your predecessors had employed?
I think so. I think I did on the whole. The divisional headquarters, the schools of thought, were divided into the woodmen and the village men. And, of course, you were influenced so much by communications and by your vulnerability to enemy direction finding. And so you always had to have what was called a radio village, which was some distance remote from your actual headquarters. We in the 1st Division were village people. We had we tended always to go and tuck, because we thought it was the safest against, and provided you didn't get some very obvious division, village. There were so many villages docked around that they couldn't really possibly know which one you were in. And of course, once you were in the barn, there was no way infrared was going to pick you up, whereas if you were in a wood, they would be able to pick you up. And so we tended to go into villages. And we had a main headquarters and a rear headquarters and a radio village, which was set apart from the radio headquarters with cable towards it so as direction finding couldn't get onto you. And I ran a small TAC headquarters, but never permanently away. I was always back at my main headquarters at night or something like that, so that you could always be got hold of. And I think that was the best way to do what we were largely fighting, was a defensive battle. If, of course, we'd suddenly gone over onto the offensive, it would have been necessary for the divisional commander to be in his TAC headquarters and very far forward, urging people to do this and that. But in a defensive battle, where you were fighting a grand design, I think you occasionally wanted to go out to see your various commanders, but you really wanted to come back to your divisional headquarters. And, of course, the divisional headquarters moved very frequently, and you usually chose a moment to go take control of your TAC headquarters while your divisional headquarters was moving. But I do remember once when they thought I'd done it, because we were always testing the divisional headquarters, but a madman escaped from a lunatic asylum, and he had an axe, and as he was running away from this lunatic asylum, he saw running from a village alongside the road an enormous thick cable, which was, of course, the cable which took the whole communications from the headquarters to the radio village. And in a fit of I don't know what, he took his axe and he cut this in two, and at one moment every single communication except my rover set went out of action. They thought the divisional commander had done it to test everybody, but I've never seen so many happy signalers. They all rushed around for about 20 minutes to restore communications. And it was a very good exercise.
Did you have to take elaborate precautions against possible attack by Russian special forces on your headquarters?
Well, I think you were always conscious of this, certainly. And I mean, we obviously had stand-to positions, and we had defence troops. And my second chief of staff was a man called Colonel Gray, who later became a lieutenant general, Mike Gray, a parachutist. And he initiated a series of the most realistic attacks on the headquarters. And yes, we certainly did.
Being a parachutist, he would have an interest, wouldn't he?
Emphasizing the crawling around with a knife in his teeth.
Roughly how much of your time was spent in the office, and how much were you able to get out and about?
Oh, I think a great deal out and about. I mean, first of all, we did a lot of training, which I either was out on or was visiting. I went to Suffield twice, I think, to see our units training over in Canada. I went round and tried to see every unit in the division as often as I possibly could. And I think you had a certain amount of things going around, visiting German towns and Bürgermeisters and your German formations. And so I would have said I was out and about a very great deal, travelling around in a helicopter or by car, helicopter a great deal, and I was in the office as little as I could be, and that was run, of course, by the Chief of Staff, or Colonel G.S., as he was still called then. And I then used to go back, and he used to have the paperwork ready for decisions and so on. But yes, I got out a great deal. I remember there were corps conferences, corps exercises, NATO exercises. They had a big exercise Lion, I think, which was something they used to have in Cologne, and we used to have to go to that. So I was out a great deal.
And you mentioned the German civil population earlier on, that you couldn't prepare elaborate defence works because they would be upset. In your 2 years running the division, did you notice any change in the attitude of the German civil community?
Well, that again is a very good question. I suppose it was just starting. I mean, not beginning to be what I believe it has since become. I mean, they were still worried about the communist threat from the east. They were grateful that Allied troops were there. They were prepared to put up with a certain amount of inconvenience, although they never lost financially, because they could always get very good claims if damage had been done to a field or a barn or something like that. And we were very careful to go round and see that damage had been kept to the minimum or they were compensated for. But by and large, we were popular. And they were prepared for us to train anywhere, not only on training areas, but in areas called 443 areas, which were declared for a particular exercise. Maybe by the end of our time, it was just beginning to get a bit more difficult to make them enthusiastic. You had to be that much more punctilious about briefing them about what was going to happen. But after I left, I think, the thing did steadily deteriorate in that way. And, of course, recently it's been extremely difficult for the British Army in Germany to train because the civilians are disenchanted with the whole idea, and, of course, there's an enormous green movement in Germany. And so, I mean, one of the reasons why the British Army of the Rhine has now been cut down so much, I mean, collapse of the Warsaw Pact is the main one, but is also that training in Germany has become very difficult indeed.
Were you ever aware of any espionage efforts against your formation while you were commanding?
No, I don't think I was. We had part of my division was in a place called Celle. Very nice old town. The Brunswick, Dukes of Brunswick and the Hanoverian House, of course, originally came from. And there was a thing called the Locating Regiment there, which was a sound mortar locating and gun locating regiment. And I think there was some story about some local civilians trying to target this particular place or people in it. I imagine it was going on all the time, but not much of it came my way at all. But I assumed that the Warsaw Pact had their agents throughout Western Germany looking for troop dispositions and so on, just as I imagine we tried to do the same on their side.
And did you see anything of them, of the regular armed forces of the Warsaw Pact? Did you ever see them across the border or go across the border?
No, because it was all done through the Commander-in-Chief and Bricksmith and people in Berlin. So we had no... We then, later, we had no contact at all with our opposite numbers on the other side. There was a Russian mission in West Germany at Lübecker, I think, which I suppose was the equivalent of Brixford's, and I think I once did go to a party given by them.
Of course, this was before the confidence-building measures introduced by the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, wasn't it?
Mm.
Your next appointment was to command British forces in Hong Kong. How much warning did you have of your...
Well, this came completely out of the blue. I mean, command of the 1st Division was my first Major General's job, and very rarely... In fact, I can't think of anybody up to that time, although one or two have done it since, have gone from first Major General job straight up to Lieutenant General. I expected to do another Major General's job in the United Kingdom, and War Office, Minister of Defence, or Staff College or something. And I was suddenly told by the commander-in-chief that I was going to Hong Kong, and I didn't realise there were two jobs then. There was a lieutenant general's job, which was CBF, and there was a major general's job below him, and I still, when he told me, didn't know which one I was going to. And I wasn't certain I was the right person to go to Hong Kong anyhow. I mean,
why was that?
Well, I didn't know anything about the Far East scene.
You'd been there before.
I'd been there as in the commanding battalion, but I hadn't been to Hong Kong before. Well, I'd visited Hong Kong once, but I'd been to Japan, of course, and I had been to Southeast Asia. That's perfectly true, but this was a very different sort of job. I mean, I suppose I got sort of wildly enthusiastic about tactics, and I was now going to find myself in a job which was very largely political. I did command the British forces, but I had a Major General second in command who took a lot of that off my shoulders. And the chief thing of being commander of British forces was that you were a member of the Executive Council. You were number two in the colony, and you spent most of your time talking about political and financial matters in the colony, about whether you should build an oil refinery here or how you were going to balance the budget and so on. And you came into this because you were responsible for security inside the colony. And it was the most wonderful training ground, so any misgivings I might have had about going there were soon dispelled when I got there, because it was absolutely fascinating. I came back into contact with the Gurkhas again. There was a military side, but it was the political side which I found most fascinating. And, of course, Hong Kong is an extraordinary, dynamic place, and you got swept up in the enthusiasm for the whole place. So I was there for 2.5 years, and the command of British forces had to work very closely with the governor. And I was very lucky, and the governor I had, Sir Murray Maclehose, now Lord Maclehose, we got on, I think, extremely well together. We thought the same way about a great many problems, the social problems, no less than many of the other problems that we discussed together. And I think it served me in very good stead later on.
What was the principal threat to the security of Hong Kong at the time?
Well, I mean, there was always a risk that... remember, no treaty had been signed by then, so you were still based on the old treaty of
1860.
Well, yes, but there was the original treaty, and then there was the new territory treaty, which of course expires in 1997. But there was never a certainty that the Chinese had accepted this, and that they wouldn't try and obtain control over the colony by some other means. And it was laughable with the troops that I had at my disposal, I suppose about 11 12,000 altogether, that we could have taken on the whole might of the People's Liberation Army if they'd been come to that. But we were again then in a deterrent to Chinese designs. We were there to indicate that the British were responsible for Hong Kong, that they had a garrison there, that they'd have to tangle with that garrison in some way, bringing all the odium amongst international opinion, and who knows, the British and the Americans might then pack in and say, you can't do this. So we were there to make a point. We weren't there to fight a last-ditch battle so much as to make a point. We also, of course, were, and this was very important, the backup to the Hong Kong, Royal Hong Kong Police in the internal security situation, because at the time of the Cultural Revolution, 1966-67, there'd been some very nasty riots in Hong Kong, and the police had needed support. So we had to have a very well jacked up internal security system. So we had to keep our forces trained and alert and ready for any eventuality.
Did you ever think that there was the slightest risk that the PLA might attempt to invade the territory?
Well, I think there is. I think there was always a slight risk, but if I didn't take it seriously, I thought that there were more than one ways of killing a cat. And there were so many other ways that China could bring pressure to Hong Kong, which would achieve much the same results, that I didn't really think.